Good evening, my name is Shane Chebsey and this is The Icecast. On The Icecast, we talk to comic artists and writers and publishers about their work, their careers and their lives and everything in between. And this evening on The Icecast, I'm very happy to welcome Mr. Kev F. Sutherland. How are you doing, Kev?
Oh, I'm very, very happy to be here, Shane. Brilliant to be talking to you.
Nah, likewise, mate, likewise. I assume you still like the F in there when you're introduced?
Yeah, it was a pretentious thing that I did. I was 17, I think, at school. And it was the thing, it was just because science fiction writers did it. You know, Elliot S. Magin would probably be the inspiration for it. Because I actually predate Ian M. Banks, even. And so I did it. And also I shortened Kevin to Kev. Because I thought it was cool. I didn't realise it just made me sound even more common than I already was. I was at school with people who, we all did that thing. You either put a V or a Z at the end. Gaz and Daz and Kev and Nev and Bev.
Yeah. Those Hev. 80s names, they're great.
Oh, aren't yeah. They? And I am married to a Hev. She was a Heather. Oh. She did exactly the same thing.
Hev and Kev.
That's us.
Fantastic. So, I mean, going back, actually talking about school, you were at school, weren't you, when you did your first thing for 2000 AD? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. 2000 AD bought Captain Klepp, scripts for Captain Klepp, when I was still at school. The very, very first thing is in a letters page. Me and my friend Steve Noble. Steve Noble and I have been going to comic conventions since our very, very first one. Yeah. In 1979, that was, in Birmingham. And we were comic fans at school, and then he moved off to another school down in Bristol. So we used to just exchange all these letters, because turns out we'd have been the only comics fan in each of our respective schools.
Well, it often was like that, wasn't it?
And he wrote a strip, and I drew it. And that was run like the size of a postage stamp in Tharg's Nerve Centre. And that was 1979 when I was still at school. Wow. And then I started sending scripts off then. Started the correspondence with Alan Grant, who was assistant editor. I had actually gone to Loughborough College of Art to do my foundation by the time my first stuff appeared, which was Captain Klepp scripts and two Tharg's Future Shocks, one in a summer special. Were they both in the summer special? I can't remember. An illustration of Roe Jaws and Hammerstein, which was in the annual, either in the 1981 annual.
Wow.
I think I signed things Kev F in those days. It might have said Sutherland. Can't remember. Anyway, yes, 2000 AD was sort of my first. It wasn't my big break, because after those things appeared,
it's just a long drought.
Well, what actually happened was more talented people turned up. I started submitting stuff at the same time as, and Alan Grant was really good at keeping you up to date with what he was doing, this other new young struggling writer called Alan Moore. And who could have predicted that his work was going to be marginally more interesting than mine? So there you go.
Well, it's all subjective, isn't it? You know?
Alan Grant, though, was really good. And if ever an opportunity was missed early, it was me missing the opportunity to pick up on. You know, Alan would basically tell you, well, everything that a good person who's helping you to get into an industry does, they say, if you have promise, they say you've got promise. And he seemed to think I did. And if you're doing something wrong, he'd tell you what you're doing wrong. And he didn't make any bones about it. He was really good about saying, because I did this Captain Klepp script, and they were a bit full of hokey old gags, in the same way as Mrs. Brown's Boys tends to use lines that were in The Golden Girls 30 years ago. Well, sadly, I was doing jokes that I'd clearly heard on I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue and nonsense like that, because I was a kid. Yeah. And he said, listen, honestly, anybody could just write old jokes that they'd heard on The Little and Large Show, and you can do better than that. And he would say a lot of things like that. I would clearly ignore them and not get any more work. I actually was concentrating on being a student, the truth be told.
I mean, the thing is, sometimes when you're younger, you don't appreciate that great advice, do you? You just don't. You think you know better, and you just carry on regardless. It doesn't matter who they are or what they say to you. It just goes in one ear and out the other.
It was a little bit of that, but I think. Yeah, you don't understand the matter, really, of what somebody is telling you, because they know so much more than you. And remember, I was 17. I actually started college when I was 17. Everyone else around me was 18. So I was particularly precocious and particularly young. And that with time, you would go back and realise what you were being told. But at the time, it was just some words that didn't quite connect. But a lot of it did. And, you know.
I think it sinks in.
I got somewhere.
It sinks in on some levels, doesn't it? Even if it is later on that you actually, you know, act on it. It's always useful to get that sage advice. So, I mean, what a great person to be mentoring you at that age. One of the best writers in the country, you know?
And an interesting thing to try and explain to the kids of today, that, of course, those were letters written. In Alan's case, they were typed, and he used no uppercase letters. He typed everything in lowercase. He said he was inspired by the sleeve notes of Bob Dylan albums. Apparently Bob Dylan did that, and Alan had just grown up doing that. But these letters, he then had to, you know, stick them in an envelope and post them. That was the way everything was done. And, I mean, maybe that doesn't take that much effort when you've got a mail room at King George Tower, but it feels like you do. And, of course, I've still, somewhere, got those letters.
Wow. It's good to keep that stuff. I've got rejection letters from Marvel that I've kept.
I could. We used to joke about being able to paper rooms with rejection letters. We are of a dying generation, the people who could do just that.
Well,
I mean, given my subsequent trajectory of my career, I did spend an awful, awful lot of time amassing rejection letters from probably the widest range of people, because, of course, I'm beginning there by sending work to IPC, who it was who published 2000 AD at that time. And I was approaching other comics at the time, although not many, because one wouldn't have considered sending work to the funny papers like Buster or Lion. No, it wasn't Lion around those days. It was Eagle, wasn't it? Eagle or any of those. Because they seemed kind of square. Eagle hadn't even started then. Tiger.
It was Tiger, wasn't it? And Eagle hadn't started up again. I think that was like early 80s, wasn't it, when Eagle had its sort of second run. I remember buying those.
Although at that same time, I one of my very early rejection letters was from Des Skin, who was the editor of Marvel UK. So I submitted stuff to Marvel UK, who were not publishing. Well, I suppose there was some little...
There was some little bits, weren't there, yeah.
Mostly reprints. But I still have and found recently a rejection letter from Des from 1979 or 80.
Wow. It's worth keeping them. But you did do, later on in your career, you did do some stuff for Marvel, didn't you? Was it in the 90s? Something like Ghost Rider 2009? That sort of
yes. Once we got up to the 90s and I was full-time working in comics, I mean, we leap ahead quite a long way.
Yeah, we do on this podcast. You'll get used to it. I go backwards and forwards a little bit.
Right. Well, yeah, once you get up to the 90s, my relationship with Marvel, well, it actually began with Doctor Who magazine, because it was in Doctor Who magazine from about 1988 to about 1991, when John Freeman was the editor.
I was going to say, was that John Freeman the editor then? Yeah.
And whenever John Freeman left as editor, that's when I stopped, which is what happens. When new editors come in, people like me go out. That's what happens.
They bring their friends with them, don't they, a lot of the time?
Yeah, well, you know, people have their different tastes. But that was the work that I found for myself in Marvel UK. Then blah, blah, blah. Then I got to work in the humour magazines, which I'd been doing at the same time. So the funny books. In fact, you can see them on... this is an audio podcast.
It is, but...
On the screen behind me, everybody, which is for a Zoom thing we're doing later in the evening, I have some of my old comics. I have the Gladiators comic, which I did in 1993. I have the Dandy, which I did in the 2016. And I have Comics 99, the comic convention that I produced from 1999 to 2004.
Well, I will put some of those pictures on the Facebook page so people can see them as well.
In between those times, though, I got to work for Marvel by sharing a studio with Mark Buckingham. I actually set up my studios to start producing the Gladiators comic, because I had the Gladiators comic and I had some T-shirt design work that I was doing for network T-shirts, including the best-selling T-shirt of Christmas 1993, Red Dwarfs, Let's Get Out There and Twat It.
You did some Red Dwarf comics as well, didn't you, if I remember correctly?
At that same time, I was also working on Red Dwarfs magazine. So I was really, really busy. I mean, I'd started my full-time freelance career in 1989 when I left whatever day jobs I'd had. So 1989, full-time freelance, moved down to the Southwest where we still live. And I had a good rollover of work. The humour magazines first, the ones that were rip-offs of Viz. Ott was the big one I worked on. But I also wrote for Gag and Cack and Zit and Blag.
I remember those.
Oh, God, there were a dozen of them. Then the Gladiators greatest comic had been a self-published thing of mine, which looked like being the great big success story, but wasn't. It ran for two issues, and then I lost money. But while I was doing all this stuff, Mark, who had been working in isolation, but we lived in the same town of Clevedon in North Somerset, he said, can I come and share the studio with you? Because it's very lonely doing this. And so for the best part of 5 years, we shared a studio together at two little different addresses in Clevedon. And when the Gladiators went tits up, and then when Red Dwarfs magazine was cancelled just before the new TV series launched, and when Zig and Zog Zogazine was cancelled after just six issues, and when Network T-shirts decided to change the range of T-shirts they were doing, so my stuff wasn't, everything started to disappear.
Wow.
And Mark took pity on me, I think it largely
was. Oh, bless him.
And I'd been helping him out with backgrounds because he was mostly inking.
Yeah.
And luckily at that point, he was moving up to penciling on Marvel titles.
Yeah.
And he had an in-house inker. So I inked Mark on Doctor Strange and on Star Trek Unlimited. And then I inked other people, including Tom Morgan and Gary Frank on those titles. And I then was starting to break into writing for Marvel. I wrote A Werewolf by Night, which I wrote and also inked, which was a very interesting process because it was Marvel.
That's interesting, yeah.
I've never used Marvel method before. You submit a synopsis of your story. The artist breaks it down. And then you get the illustrated version of your story with everything paced wrong and all the gags not left room for. Because I'm a gag writer, so I write stories with joke structures, and then I write lots of setups for punchlines.
Yeah.
And in the Marvel method, you don't do that.
That's not going to work, is it?
You've got to let the writer decide that's going to be big, that's going to be small, and there's going to be more pictures, and the page turn's not even going to be where you've got the page turn. Anyway, then I put the dialogue over the top of it, and then it went away, and then it came back, and then I inked it. So weird way of working.
It must be, yeah.
And so I was making inroads there. I was submitting work for Doctor Strange and for Ghost Rider 2099, and the 2099 titles, and they had this Dark Universe title, which had Morbius in. I was writing stories for those.
That was all good stuff. I remember that stuff. It was all good stuff.
Yeah. And I was on the brink of acceptance when Marvel filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Oh, it was that time, wasn't it? Yeah.
That's right. So there's
wrong
an
entire... place at the wrong time, Kev.
Totally.
Every time.
It was last in, first out there. And so there's an entire Doctor Strange giant size, which I think is like 35 pages, which I inked over, I think, a Filipino artist. It was the best quality artwork, written by J.M. DeMatteis, it's never been published.
Seriously?
And I know it hasn't, because I went to, it was FP in Glasgow, of all places. I found the essential Doctor Strange collection, and I found my work in there, and I found the whole collection of stuff. I hadn't even been told about this. I certainly didn't get any payment for it, and I could categorically show that final story that I did never appeared, because then Doctor Strange went away and came back under a different line of guys and everything. And the last communication I had from that sort of version of Marvel was a letter saying they'd overpaid me for Star Trek royalties, so the next job I did for them, I owed them $250.
Oh, God!
And I've not worked for them since. I mean, I happily would, and I would happily pay them the $250, but it's not come about.
No. Oh, well, Marvel's a very different animal now to what it was in the late 90s.
That was 25 years ago. Well,
yeah.
Yeah, 1998 must have been when I... No, God, I've lost track of the years. When were we? 1990. It was 1998. Yeah,
that was before, because that was before you started doing the Bristol Convention, wasn't it? That sort of led... You sort of went from that sort of into doing your events, didn't you?
It was sort of the reason that I started the Bristol Con. Mark and I together started the National Comics Awards, and we ran those in 1997, at the same time as we were still working for Marvel and they hadn't gone under yet. And National Comics Awards, we first held them in London as part of UCAC, and they were presented by Jonathan Ross at the Hotel Russell, and Paul Gambaccini co-presented them, and they both did it for free.
Did they?
Jonathan Ross for free because he wasn't doing his chat show yet, and he was kind of between, he wasn't doing his Radio 2 radio show, he was kind of between gigs, and such a big comics fan, he did it for love. And Paul Gambaccini similarly did it for love, because he read out, as we were doing the results of the Comic Festival, he read out the Comics Awards, the American Comics Awards results from, I think it was 1963, when he'd been an Uber fan. And for some reason, the convention hadn't happened, so these had never been read out.
Oh, wow.
Something like that.
Gambaccini, I mean, he had such like an encyclopedic knowledge, didn't he, of that period of comics, you know, that sort of 60s and Silver Age and the Golden Age. He seemed very knowledgeable about all that.
Yeah. Do you know, I don't know if I've heard Paul do a radio show or a TV show about comics.
I've seen him on TV, like doing segments. You know, I remember seeing, I think it was Breakfast TV. He used to appear on Breakfast TV a lot, didn't he? And yeah. I remember him doing little segments about Golden Age books and things like that, and he showed stuff that he owned. And
I've seen him being wheeled out when comics creators have died.
That's normally the way. Yeah.
That is the lot of certain. There's certain people, aren't there? There's a Lou Stringer, Paul Gravett, Toby Haydoke, if it's somebody from Doctor Who, Paul Gambaccini, and Jonathan Ross, if you can get him.
Yeah.
If one of the old people that only we have heard of snuffs it.
Indeed, yeah. Yes. Although I really enjoyed that documentary that Neil Gaiman and Jonathan Ross did about Steve Ditko.
Yes, no, that was brilliant. That's the thing with Jonathan. He militated for these things because his passion about them was so much about sharing them, and he had access to the TV and really wanted to capitalise on it. And I'm sure would still do if he could. Paul, you know, is actually more interested in music, and given the choice, he would happily talk more about music, which makes better radio than comics.
I'm sure it does. Yeah, radio and comics. I mean, I've had some challenges with this podcast, actually, with it being audio, you know, which is why we're also doing the live shows. So we've got video on those, and we'll have to get you on there at some point. But yeah, this has been a challenge, but it's also really good because it gets you can talk about other aspects as well as the visual, you know.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
So after Marvel, you went and you did your shows with Mark. Was Mark still involved with 99?
No. He had been involved with the National Comics Awards.
Yeah.
But to be honest, he was busier writing drawing comics than I was. And so he would be there and would support everything. And of course, he designed the statuette for the National Comics Awards.
Yeah.
And he would co-present. But once I got up to Comics 99... I took it much more on my own until Mike Allwood stepped in.
Mike Allwood.
From Area 51 Comics on Gloucester Road in Bristol, who just basically, I think he just came up to me and said, "Kev, you can't do this on your own. Clearly, you know, let some people who have the vaguest idea how to do this help you." And so he did more and more of it until eventually he ended up doing it. Although... Yeah. I stayed with the Comic Festival long enough to lose money, which everybody does. Loses money when they lose Comic Festival.
I can testify to that, definitely.
Yes, yes.
I've lost fortunes over the years.
Yeah.
but we do it for the love, don't we? Not for the money. Yes.
I consoled myself. When 2004 was the last one I did, and it went very badly because... I had hired some sound equipment from the venue, and the terms and conditions weren't clear to me, and it left the event £2,000 out of pocket, which was very badly, it was a mess. And then it meant I couldn't do the one I was going to do in, I can't remember how it happened. Anyway, I remember.
London ones as well. For a while you did a London one as well at Bloomsbury.
Yeah. But what I remember is that Des Skin did his first Brighton one. Now, did it clash with the thing that I was doing in the autumn, or did I not do something in the autumn at all? I can't remember. But I remember thinking of Des's Con, and I love Des, and I support Des greatly.
2005,
but
I remember, it was,
Right, well, he did... was it? I thought he did...
Yeah, I only remember because the year after we did our first Con.
Right. Well, I thought of his first event as a spoiler Con, because... It had in some way stopped me doing my, I don't know, it's water under the bridge, and I honestly cannot remember the details. But Des did come clean about how much money he'd lost, and he had lost 6 or 7 times as much money on his first Brighton event as I had, because he went bigger. because he was dead. And he got a much bigger venue, a far, far too big venue.
Oh, yeah.
And things conspired against him, including the weather and some other clashing events. And I don't know what they were. But
It was a great event, though, Kev. I was an exhibitor at that event. And it was a fantastic event. I really had a good time. But I've used that hotel, and I know how expensive it is. And
You sure that wasn't a second one that he did?
He only did the one.
So that, well, anyway, we'll have to ask Des, I'm sure. Des has a far better encyclopedic memory than me. I mean, I can't even remember stuff about me. So remembering stuff about other people is where someday a big libel suit will bring me down.
Well, if there's anything that you think you might have got wrong that could get you into trouble, just let me know and I'll edit it out.
I don't think I've said anything more than Des once lost some money. And that's actually safe ground.
Yes.
Des, like all of us, has both made money and lost money.
Yes, conventions are a really good way of losing money. If ever you've got too much money and you want to get rid of it, just run a comic convention.
Yeah, well, see, again, a lot of people who get involved with things like this, whether it's events or whether it's publishing, if they're like me, they do it idealistically rather than from a business point of view. I'm sure there are people who succeed from doing things, you know, because they should happen, as well as people who do it purely with their business head on. But yeah, in my case, it was very much a thing that I thought should happen, a thing that wasn't happening. And it's because UCAT had gone down the pan the previous year, 1998, when Frank and Haas lost money. They had money stolen, in fact.
Oh, where did they? Because it was in Manchester, the last one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember going to that.
Now, again, I'm getting facts wrong. In some year or other, charity money was stolen from them. And in another year, they just lost money. I can't remember. Anyway, they certainly stopped. They certainly stopped doing conventions for whatever reason. The reason's usually losing money. Yeah. And so I stepped in 1999 in a way that you can't do nowadays because I inherited his mailing list, which I think is illegal now under GDPR legislation. But as it was, I got this great mailing list from Frank back in the days before email, or back in the days before I had email. And so just lots of letters in envelopes to lots of people inviting them to come to this comic convention. But my idealistic thing was, and the programme is visible behind me, Batman, Judge Dredd, Spider-Man and Dennis the Menace. Yeah. The idea was to attract people who didn't already read comics.
Yeah.
That was my big shtick. And so you could get in for £2.50 or you could pay extra if you wanted the whole deal.
Yeah,
if you
want the fanboy pass, wasn't it?
Yeah. That's right, there was the fanboy
pass. I stole that idea, actually.
Ah, you're welcome.
Thank you, Kev. As well as being a comic artist, I'm not sure if everybody listening knows, you also do comedy, so you've done TV work and you've done some live comedy work.
I know, I was looking around for something to hold up to the camera, realising there's no point, there's no camera. But yes, the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre.
Yes.
I was doing stand-up at first, and the stand-up sort of rolled into the comic conventions because I started doing on-stage presenting and interviewing at Frank and Haas's UCAX, GlasCAX, and ManCAC. Gosh, ManCAC. I'm glad they didn't call it ManCAC. That would have been the worst.
ManCAC would be the worst.
Yeah, you deserve to lose all that money if you called it ManCAC, didn't you? Anyway, I was doing stand-up, and then I was doing a sketch show called The Sitcom Trials, took that to the Edinburgh Festival and got a real taste for the whole promotion thing. And then I did, as part of The Sitcom Trials, I did a routine with a couple of socks on my hands. They turned out to be funnier than me. And so I stopped doing stand-up and eventually was just doing sock puppets, which I have now been doing I did their first Edinburgh year in 2007. So I have been up to the Edinburgh Festival a dozen times since then.
Wow.
I should have been up there this year, but obviously that didn't happen.
Unfortunately, yeah. But that's quite an achievement to have a spot in the Edinburgh Festival that many times, isn't it? Because not many people do they?
The thing with the Edinburgh Festival is you pay to play. And so although you have to get accepted by a venue and you have to bring in an audience, otherwise you lose money. I was very lucky that the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre are popular, so popular that people come in increasing numbers every year. And so when you watch programmes about the Edinburgh Festival, you quite often see comedians saying, I go up there, but I lose like £15,000. Well, I run my Edinburgh Festival, not in the way that Des ran his comic festival, in that I actually make money when I come away from Edinburgh, or fingers crossed, touch wood, have done so for the last dozen years.
Oh, that's really good. That's really good. Because I know a lot of stand-ups don't make a lot of money on their shows, on their festival shows at least. The
Edinburgh Festival, the Edinburgh Fringe, is a showcase for a lot of people. Yeah. You can use it to promote your work that you'll get the rest of the year round, be that in comedy clubs or theatres. It's theatres in our case, mostly. Mm-hmm. And people trying to get on the telly. A lot of people are trying to get on the telly and they use Edinburgh in that way.
Yeah.
And whether that'll change, I don't know. 2020 has been a big year for change in live events in particular, which, of course, I was going to take advantage of big time with my comics publishing this year. Yeah. That was the whole plan, because we haven't even talked about
We're getting around to it. So we may as well, now that you've brought it up, talk about it's Finlay Macbeth, isn't it, the book?
Hang on. I know there's not a video, but I'm going to change my background. There you go. Check those out. I've got them here in my hands as well. But yes, I've produced three books. Findlay Macbeth was the first one. The Prince of Denmark Street is the second one.
Okay.
And Midsummer Night's Dream Team is the one that is just at the printers now. I think listeners will be able to tell what my shtick is. I didn't intend doing a series of books. Findlay Macbeth, which obviously is the Scottish play, but then adapted in my style. Yeah. I'm holding the pictures up to the fully.
Hey, well, I'm enjoying looking at it. So what's it about, Kev? Give us the elevator pitch.
The elevator pitch is that for Findlay Macbeth, I have taken the story and I have updated it to 1977. It is essentially Abigail's party meets Macbeth. The way it began was the way I wanted to stage the play. Now, I've put a few things on stage before, but I've never staged a full play. And I chatted with a few of my actor mates about this and about how you would do Macbeth. And Macbeth, I've seen done so many times, and I think a lot of people missed the point or didn't see it in the same way as me, because they make him heroic, they make him dramatic. I've seen him with Patrick Stewart, and he's been done with Mel Gibson, did him, didn't he? Or did he do Hamlet?
I remember the Martin Shaw version.
Oh, blimey, I don't remember that. But yeah, they're kind of flawed heroes. Where my reading of the book has always been that he was a put-upon, henpecked husband, and that Lady Macbeth is much more of a significant player, and that the witches, who in my book are the three secretaries, because the whole thing takes place in 1977, Albert Industries, which is a Scottish manufacturing company, and basically Findlay Macbeth and Banquo are the sales force. So rather than being conquering kings, you've got people who are in a middle management structure. Now it does still involve stabbing and killing and
mugs. I'll
give you my favourite bit of violence, which, spoiler alert, a dead child. But I particularly enjoyed
listening, there's a very graphic image of a dead, rotting face there.
It's not rotting, it's just newly splattered with blood.
Macduff's
kids. Macduff goes away to hide in England. It all follows the original story of the play.
So they still got the original names as well. So Macduff and Banquo and...
They've got different
Duncan.
First names.
Right.
Yeah, so it's Stuart Banquo and Alan Duncan and... Colin Macduff. It's Duncan McCrinnan. Their surnames actually link back to their original clan names. And I was really chuffed when I was naming the book to find that Findlay Macbeth, Findlay is my middle name. That's what the F stands for in Kev F. Sutherland. And Macbeth was in the same clan as the Findlays. It's not spelt F-I-N-D-L-A-Y. No. It's spelt in a Gaelic way, but it's Findlay. And so we are, in some way, quite possibly related. Hence my knowledge that he would definitely have to be a skinny weenyaff. He would be a wimp. He would be me, much more than he would be Patrick Stewart. And so there's your feeling with that. And so I did that book, self-published it. I ran a Kickstarter, my first Kickstarter, and it was very successful. Covered the printing costs, although it didn't cover the cost of sending copies out to all the Kickstarter supporters.
That's what you learned, watch out for.
I learned that lesson. Yeah. But it meant that this, I'm holding up to the camera the dummy version, which is done on Blurb, which is actually the wrong size. The paperback itself is bigger.
Right.
Because Blurb make their books the wrong shape. They make them small and skinny.
Yeah,
I don't know why they do that.
Totally different.
But that's the only way I can proof them is by doing a Blurb copy.
And
then I get the actual one produced by Stuart Guild of Citrus Printing.
Fabulous
printers. He's now got a different printing name and I can't remember it. But Stuart Guild. Look for Stuart Guild. He's never let me down yet. Yeah. And I've bought barcodes and everything.
Oh,
I've got it listed with Nielsen and Gardeners and Askews and Holt.
You'll get about three orders a year off them.
I got two, and then the very next day I got an email saying they'd been ordered in error.
That happened to me once. They ordered two copies of Dead by Dawn, I think it was, an old book I used to publish. And I got the order, and I was, I've got an order for... it was to Waterstones via them, you know.
Yeah.
And I sent it off. I sent off the invoice, and then they sent me a letter back saying this order was by accident.
Yeah. I got exactly the same. I get the impression it's a test thing on the system.
I think it is.
When a new item comes in. Yeah. My second book doesn't even appear on the Waterstones system. The first book appears on the Waterstones system and you're told it's out of stock, which is brilliant. Askews and Holt is the company that libraries order through. And I only discovered this when I contacted one of the many libraries who I visit. And they said, we can't get things booked directly from you. Mm. So I'm going through all this minefield. But the big plan. The big plan for 2020, because because my quiet months are going to be January, I have very few visits to schools in January, very little artwork on, because, you know, in the run-up to Christmas, I've been drawing people's Christmas cards and commissions and stuff. So I thought, I'm going to have time to do this. And I drew Finlay Macbeth in January in the first couple of days of February, a month to draw. And I was well pleased with that. I did it deliberately, not quickly, but I established a style which meant I could do it in that period of time.
And you planned that period of time to do it in.
Yeah. And then the Kickstarter. And then it was to emerge from the Kickstarter. And I had the first festivals lined up for, I think it was the Bath one, I think it was March, if not definitely April. And then April, May, June, festival. I had book festivals that I was doing my classes at, as well as the comic festivals that I was going to make a big splash return to. Yeah. And everybody knows what happened next. And so that's when the lockdown book came about.
So that's where that book came about, because you had all this spare time.
March and April, right through the summer, my diary would have been full of visits to schools and comedy gigs, because the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre, the way it works is you build up to the Edinburgh Fringe by doing preview shows through the preceding month, and also and touring the previous year's show. So I did a couple of gigs in February at the Leicester Comedy Festival, and that was the end of it. The first ones I cancelled was the Glasgow Comic Festival, which is the third week of March.
Yeah.
And it was in the first week of March where you suddenly realised you're going to have to cancel everything before it cancels you. So all the things that I would be doing stopped. And I've plotted out on a calendar the working days. And I didn't even take a weekend off drawing The Prince of Denmark.
Wow.
Wrote it starting in March and drew it through April and May. And it was published in June.
Wow.
So solidly.
What's that one about then, Kev?
So I took Hamlet, and this was from a standing start, though. Whereas with Finlay Macbeth, I'd had the idea of how I would stage the play and turned that into a graphic novel.
Yeah.
With The Prince of Denmark Street, I started from scratch. I butted around lots of ideas, and I've got lots on the back burner. The next book I'm planning, I don't want to tell you about because it's brilliant. spoilers. But one of the ones that's on the to-do list is The Merchants of Leicester.
Oh, well, Merchant of Venice. Yeah, right.
And that was very nearly the one I did second. And it's The Merchant of Venice, but it's set in Leicester. Again, it's 1977. All three of these books are set in 1977.
Oh, right, so they're all 70s. Settings.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And for The Merchant of Venice, I was going to tackle racism. The Merchant of Venice does that it has the subject as part of its
Yeah.
With me, Shylock wasn't going to be Jewish. Shylock was going to be Indian.
Right.
And I grew up in Leicester in the 1970s. Mm. I'm originally from Scotland, but then I was in Leicester in the 1970s. Mm. And so I wanted to look at that world and see what happens when, and it was, but it was really problematic and really challenging because it includes things like taking the doth a Jew not bleed and replacing the Jew with the P word.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work, does it?
Well, I think it does, but I also think it's dangerous because, for a start, there's not going to be a school that's going to have the P word. I'm not even going to say the P word.
No, it's a horrible word.
You've got the P word and you've got the N word, which have to appear in this book.
Yeah.
And then you've got lots of role reversals in the other. Anyway, that's the one that I've been too chicken to finish writing. So instead, I did A Prince of Denmark Street so that Hamlet, or rather Joe Hamlet, your Prince Hamlet.
Got you.
He's the lead singer of the Danes with Rosencrantz on drums, Guildenstern on bass, and Horatio Starr. That's the one there who looks like Elvis Costello.
It looks like Elvis Costello, yeah.
It does. He's the guitarist, and they write the songs together. And that is Ophelia. And she's kind of a hippie singer-songwriter, slightly in the Joan Armour trading vein. And her dad is an old hippie called Polonius Monk. And Uncle Claude, so Claudius, who bops off Hamlet's dad, is now Claude Rich, who's the boss of the record label. And it's all set on Denmark Street, which is Tin Pan Alley, which is the heart of the British music industry. And in 1977, it still was the heart of the music industry.
Yeah.
The Sex Pistols stayed in a flat above number 6 at Denmark Street and recorded in the basement studios. And the publishers were there, and there were various venues there, including the Gioconda Cafe that a lot of people hang out on. And in the back of all of these books, as well as doing my 120-page graphic novel, I have the full text of the Shakespeare play illustrated by me. And then in the back of The Prince of Denmark Street, there's a bonus thing. I wrote an article, A Brief History of Denmark Street. I did a video, which you'll find on YouTube, A Brief History of Denmark Street.
Okay, and I wrote it.
Just as part of my research,
and
then the text of the video became an article in the back of the book because it became fascinating. But of course, it was lockdown, so I couldn't go to Denmark Street. I finally got to Denmark Street in September when Heather and I finally went to London.
Yeah.
And I tell you, the most disappointing street on God's good earth is actually Denmark Street because it's mostly being knocked down,
and they're
retaining the facades, but they're putting posh apartments behind them. But the streets that Denmark Street backed onto, it doesn't back onto anymore.
It's
They've been knocked down.
And
you know, another thing I was disappointed about by Denmark Street is it didn't get mentioned in Dez, starring David Tennant. Did you watch that?
Where he played? Yeah. Yes.
Dennis Nielsen worked at the job centre on the corner of Denmark Street in 1980.
Seriously, I didn't know that.
In my article.
Wow. I did enjoy that documentary, actually. I thought it was really... Well, it wasn't a documentary. It was a dramatisation. Sorry. I watched the documentary afterwards. They did a documentary.
Yes, that's
real
right.
Real Dares, didn't they? It was,
Oh, the true stories of Denmark Street are fabulous and fascinating.
I bet.
And I'm hoping that the music bookshop... and Sheet Music Shop is going to stock it. I'm in correspondence with them. But getting stuff into shops is really difficult.
It's hard.
The big problem is that shops aren't open. Ever since I've been self-publishing, shops have been closed. There's a couple... The thing... If I've been told once, I've been told it half a dozen times, oh, you should take that to the shop at the RSC in Stratford-on-Avon. And my mate, who does guided tours, Clive, he does guided tours at the Globe, he contacted me on Facebook. He said, oh, Kev, your book looks brilliant. You should sell that in the bookshop at the Globe. I said, you could probably help me there, Clive, because you work at the Globe, don't you? So is the bookshop open? Oh, no, it's not open, Kev. No. We don't know when it's reopening, but you should be in there.
So, thanks
in anticipation, Clive, but it's not happened yet, has it?
Have you talked to schools about getting the books in schools?
Yes. At the moment, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing because I contacted the schools that I was supposed to appear at. I told them about the book. That's when I heard about Askews and Holt. Mm. A couple of individuals joined me on the Kickstarter and a couple of individuals have bought the books themselves because it sells on Amazon as well.
Yeah.
Amazon print on demand, everybody. I can heartily recommend. Yeah. I get £1.19 every time I sell one of my
five. It's not bad,
books.
Actually, is it? It's not bad. They do a lot of the work. And my son publishes his own comic and he sells it on Amazon, just on Amazon. And he's had a few little technical issues with them, but for the most part, they do a lot of the work for you, and, you know, printing-wise.
The technical issue that I have had on the three books in a row so far on Amazon Print and Demand is the spine. It keeps coming back to me saying, make the text smaller on the spine. And if you get the Amazon version, I doubt you can read the words on the spine, because I've had to condense them so much for their algorithm, I think it is. It's a person who's writing this.
Strange, isn't it?
So
there's a different version for Amazon. It's a different print run.
It's got a different spine.
Yeah.
But it's got the same barcode.
Yeah.
Oh, there's the blurb version. It's got two barcodes. I don't know that. And if that's even strictly legal. You can't buy the blur version. It's just a dummy.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then I did a third book, because I realised we're coming to the end of this interview.
We better get to that one as well, yeah.
Having published The Prince of Denmark Street in June, I thought things would get back to normal. And to an extent they did, because I was able to start doing my classes, my comic art master classes, on Zoom.
Right.
A couple of the schools that had had me booked contacted me in June and said, we'll have you doing the classes on Zoom. And so I did those classes, and an arts centre had me back to do their classes.
Great.
And then I approached the other schools, and then I realised what the catch-22 was there. And that is that the schools that contacted me, the schools that had me in, were posh schools.
Right.
The posh schools had already had their kids working on individual iPads at home. And they had been doing their classes since March, individually on iPads. And when I contacted more of the schools that I'd regularly worked with, I was told they weren't allowed to have Zoom. Some councils have said that.
Oh.
Some individual schools have decided that for security reasons. And things work very, very slowly in state schools.
Yeah.
And then kids don't have their own laptops. They don't have their own rooms. They don't have their own iPads. It's very, very different when you're working in normal schools.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the summer holidays happened, obviously.
Mm.
And the new term has just been too difficult for people. I've contacted people and they've had problems with those resources they can't use. They've had problems with, they have to bubble in small classes. And then they've had problems that, like along the lines of, Kev, you know, I said we could have you in October. Well, we've just had to close the school because some kids are self-isolating.
Yeah.
And everything that can go wrong, and I feel for the schools, I'm not so worried about me. It would be nice to be earning money, but, the nightmarish situation that so many of these schools are having to go through is something you wouldn't wish on anybody.
Yeah, I've got a lot of friends who are teachers and they're all going through this. It's an absolute nightmare. Yeah.
The thing that puzzled me actually was, I was talking to a couple of my teacher friends. We did on a Zoom thing, and they just started the schools up in Scotland. And within a week, everybody had colds.
Yeah.
Ow!
Yeah.
How had they caught colds?
They just, kids just generate colds, don't they?
But they were doing all the things to stop getting the COVID, which is washing your hands and having masks. And so how'd the cold got through? I still can't square that circle. But yeah, everybody seems to have been getting normal common cold.
I think colds are, the common cold, I think, is even more virulent than COVID. You know, it's an incredibly virulent and adaptive, because the common cold is obviously lots and lots of different viruses. And it's incredible, actually, how resilient it is. You know, thank God it doesn't kill people.
It is very strange that an entire nation of amateur virologists, as we all are now, although I'm not entirely sure whether I'm an amateur virologist or an amateur epidemiologist, because I'm not an amateur lexicographer and therefore don't know the difference between the two words. But none of us seems to be able to answer any question whatsoever about COVID.
No.
And we've had 9 months. And everybody disagrees on almost everything.
Well, there's so much disagreement, because there's a lot of it that hasn't been established yet. You know, I work. I'm a microbiologist, and I don't work in that field. But I don't work. It's not my area of specialty. But
you know a petri dish from a bell jar, which is more than most of us.
But you hear stuff. You know, and there's no consensus. That's the problem.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I swat up an awful lot on maths and stats and science. And my favourite show on the radio is More or Less on Radio 4, which gives the lie to statistical misreporting. And even then, you can find a contradictory version of everything you've been told at some point or another. And talking of things that are persistent, I had a third book because the school still weren't happening. So Midsummer Night's Dream Team was my version of Midsummer Night's Dream, where the elevator pitch for this is that Quince gets the gang together for one last job. I've turned Midsummer Night's Dream into a heist movie.
Wow, what a great idea.
So Finlay Macbeth was a stage play. Prince of Denmark Street was a musical, really, because they sing songs. And at the back of Prince of Denmark Street, there is the album cover for the soundtrack of the songs that they sing to the Shakespearean. So when they do straight Shakespearean lyrics, often they're done as songs in Prince of Denmark Street, which makes them less jarring, because it makes it's okay to be saying those things in rhyme when you're being a punk band or being a hippie. Midsummer Night's Dream Team, there's a jewel theft that takes place during the marriage of Theo the Greek and Hippolyta at Athens Restaurant, which is next door to Woods, the nightclub, which is where Titania and Oberon and Puck and all the dancers are having a ball. And there's the star-crossed lovers as well. And there's the band, Pyramus and Thisbe, doing their concept album, Pyramus and Thisbe. But this is all being reported during interviews down at the police station with Inspector Filostrate, who's pretty much a subsidiary character in the play, but a real character in the play. So she is now the police inspector, based on Helen Mirren. And she is trying to find out who are the suspects, and we have unreliable narrators, so you get different versions of the stuff, which is how you can get magic things happening, including I'll show you one of the bits which is really incongruous, but I loved throwing this in, and that is the invasion of the were-donkey, and I've done the American Werewolf in London transformation scene, and that is Bottom turning into a donkey. Instead of I didn't mean to call you a werewolf, a meatloaf Jack, it's I didn't mean to call you a knave Peter Quince.
So, honestly, guys, everyone listening to this, that book is worth getting just for that double page spread. It's absolutely brilliant.
my favourite line is, because they use the wall, you see, the band, Pyramus and Thisbe, the wall appears in the story of Pyramus and Thisbe, and they have a collapsible wall, which they use as part of their performance routine. And of course, this is them performing their concept album, featuring a wall. And Constable Bill, who's the sidekick to Inspector Filostrate, says, "It's 1977. Trust me, nobody's ever going to want to see a concept album about a wall." My favourite line in the book.
Shameless. I love that.
I'm shameless.
Shameless, yeah.
So that is at the printers now. The Kickstarter this time, all of the Kickstarters have succeeded better than the previous one.
And, brilliant.
The last two, we've also covered the postage.
Could you say, I mean, I'm quite interested in this, because obviously you've done three Kickstarters now. Kickstarter gives you a lot of data, doesn't it, about who's sort of buying your
book. Yes.
What would you say was the sort of primary demographic for these books? Who's buying them? What sort of age groups? What sort of people?
Oh, I don't think if it gives me the age groups, I've not looked.
It doesn't give you that.
But
okay.
Well, it may do.
Kickstarter does give you quite a bit of data, doesn't it?
Certainly, geographical locations are interesting, and whether or not I already knew people, that thing I can establish.
Yeah.
And I have drawn on a lot of people from the people I know through my comics people, and on Facebook is where I keep in touch with a lot of my comics people, and a number of them have supported this book. Some of my school's people, but mostly the ones that I contacted directly and told about it. A lot of the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre supporters, because we've got a very good fan base there. When I was doing my Zoom classes, and I organised a couple of classes myself over the summer. It was only friends and Sox fans that got on board with that. I couldn't reach a broader general public, sadly. Yeah. However, Kickstarter does. There appear to be people who look at Kickstarter to find comics and books that they might be interested in, and things that they might want to support. So people have come out of the blue who I had never heard of, and they have supported the Kickstarter. So that's one thing I can tell you. It's helped me find an audience that I hadn't found through other routes.
That's really good to hear. I mean, I've heard similar things about Kickstarter from other publishers, and obviously it doesn't always work for everybody, but I think if you, you know, if you run your campaign in the right way, it seems that you really can reach a whole new audience of people, because Kickstarter has this great way of recommending books. I mean, I support stuff on Kickstarter, and I've discovered stuff that otherwise would never have read, you know. So it is, I think it is good for that.
I find it really interesting as a browsing platform for a sort of state of the art of an area of comics, because as you and I know, we've been enjoying, we've been joining in with the chats based on Hannah Berry's comics survey, which she did in association with the Lakes Comics Festival. And that is introducing me to a world of comics and comics publishing, which I didn't really know existed. I've been out of the comics fray for a bit of a time. I've been working in the Beano, but that's its own parallel universe.
I mean, we hadn't really got to that bit, have we, of your career? Because you worked for the Beano for quite a while, didn't you?
God, have we not mentioned the Beano?
We haven't mentioned the Beano.
the most famous, and I would say most successful comics work that I have done in my entire career has been my work for the Beano. That came about as a result of the comic festivals, which is where... mine were the first comic festivals, I think, which made a big deal about inviting the Beano down. The Beano won the first National Comics Awards big prize of the best British comic of all time. And Ewan Kerr, the editor, came down and accepted that. They subsequently kept coming to my festivals. The Beano would always send people down. They got really involved. And I asked Ewan, the editor of the Beano, if I submitted something, you know, is there a chance? Because he was starting to use very interesting creators. He was using Hunt Emerson, and he was using a guy called Mike Perkins. So I've got his name wrong.
There is a Mike Perkins, but that's another guy.
It's another guy. Heavens. I do this all the time.
You're not the only one.
Senior moment. Anyway, his work was on the Bash Street Kids Singled Out, and he would do long stories featuring the Bash Street Kids. He did, around 2000, a millennium, turn of the millennium story, which ran through the whole issue, 30-page story.
Wow.
And they did the same when he did a Halloween story, and he did the Beano birthday issue. And they're like Asterix books. He had a really He had a really European style of writing and drawing. And the subs didn't rewrite his words because he lettered his own voice bubbles without any changes.
Oh, he did his own lettering?
Yeah. And Ewan was up for that. Oh, and Gary Northfield came in at about the same time.
Yes,
with
I remember.
Dawn the Sheep.
Yeah.
And so I got in there. 2003, I wrote something which somebody else drew. And then from 2004, I was writing and drawing stuff that appeared in there. The only stuff you can really get your hands on would be the annuals, written and drawn by me, the annuals from 2007, 2008, 2009, where I did 16-page long stories. Bash Street Kids Adventures, Roger the Dodger's Reservoir Dodge. I also wrote Billy the Cat versus General Jumbo, which is drawn by Nigel Dobbin. Sadly, the late Nigel Dobbin.
Lovely guy Nigel was. Very missed.
Well, an amazing artist as well.
Yeah.
And he actually went on to write and draw the Billy the Cat stories. Fantastic. Mm. But I squeezed a couple in as well. And then I was in the weekly up until a change of editor. It was a change.
There we go again, new editor.
I survived one change of editor.
All right.
But then there was a change of senior editor, and they changed the pattern of the books.
Yeah.
And so my stories, which were, I did 16-page stories, which were serialized in 4-page chunks over 4 issues.
Right.
And they stopped doing that and haven't really done that since. The long stories I did, occasionally I had stories which ran through the most of the whole issue. I did a 16-page Christmas one, 2005.
Right. Yeah.
So the rest of the comic got shunted out for me to do these long stories.
Oh, yeah.
And that was amazing.
Yeah.
But that pattern changed. I've come back subsequently writing Banana Mans and writing and drawing Pansy Potters as shorter strips. And in a recent annual, I wrote the Nashers, and I wrote the Banana Mans, and I wrote the Bash Street Kids, and I did them as overlapping storylines.
But unfortunately, no crossover.
Unfortunately, I wrote them, but other artists drew them.
Got you.
And I didn't feel able to ask the artist to give me a credit, which I did occasionally. I've asked Nigel Parkinson to give me a credit, which he did, and then didn't credit himself.
Oh. There's a couple of stories
which I appear to have done everything on, and clearly I haven't. I've done those uncredited. My big stuff ran 2004 to 2009 in the Beano.
That's a good chunk of time, isn't it?
I'm well pleased with them. I'm hoping the kids who grew up on those will rediscover me and buy these books.
Well, you never know.
Live in hope.
Well, another chap I had on here who was also worked in the Beano, Lou Stringer, he's self-published stuff. And, that, you know, he's built a fan base based on his, you know, on his followings from other work, you know, that's done really well. So I think you can do that, definitely. You know, if you're established and
And this is quite a significant point about the bookshops, because as you can see, I'm doing my books now in the form of paperback books. My graphic novels are 120 pages of comic strip story plus the play, so they end up about 180 pages, which is I think it's worth $5.99. And my aim is to get into bookshops because I think that is where you sell stuff. I don't think comic shops or any other area.
Well, I think material like this, definitely, I think bookshops is the place.
And this is a conversation I've been having with the Beano for over a decade now. I have been putting forward packages, and I've made a couple of dummies of my own work, because I think the work that I did packaged together in a graphic novel fits automatically onto the shelves of the Waterstones. And with the Beano brand, I think you've got a big seller. The Beano disagree. The Beano have been doing textbooks with some pictures, and Nigel Octolooney, who writes and draws Dennis the Menace, writes Dennis the Menace and writes and draws the Numbskulls, he's done a few of these books, but they're never full comic strip, which is the Beano's USP.
Yeah.
I think new original graphic novels by these top creators. I mean, they've got Laura Howell, they've got Gary Norfield, they've got Hunt Emerson, they've got Nigel Octolooney, they've got Nigel Parkinson, they've got the best creators.
Amazing creators.
Who do top-notch stuff, which a 200-page black and white paperback book, manga style, I think the Beano would rule the roost with
it. Oh, it'd sell. And I know that Beano is still really popular, because I found that when I did my festival last year for Comics Salopia, we did lots and lots and lots of events with all different types of artists and writers. And apart from one event, which was Sonia Leong doing a manga workshop, which was our top selling event, the biggest selling events, we did three Beano events, and all three of them were huge.
Yeah.
Packed, absolutely packed.
If you speak to the general public, this is what I found from, because I've been going into schools since my visits to schools began with my comic festival way back in 2003. So I've been going into schools ever since then. And I talk to the general public all the time. And apart from the occasional, oh, does the Beano still exist then? And, oh, the Hulk, is that a comic too? Which I feel that I have heard more than once. It is unbelievable. People are not aware of comics, but if they're aware of any comic, they're aware of the Beano.
Yeah.
And that has not really changed. And if you talk to kids, they will be aware first of the Beano, secondly of Marvel movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Thirdly,
maybe
the Phoenix.
Spider-Man, you know.
Well, fourthly, after the Phoenix, they will be aware that comics exist, that Marvel comics exist.
Yeah.
And then older teenagers, it's manga. And it's manga all the way. From the age of 12 and up, it's manga all the way.
Yeah.
It's one in 1,000 kids who will read Marvel comics.
Yeah.
Marvel comics are so, so rare.
Yeah.
And that kid, of course, will be pathological about comics.
Yeah.
And will bring in his entire collection.
Yeah.
And it will always be a boy, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Usually.
But manga very different. Manga is the one that they swap, and the one that they share. It's
and a lot of girls read manga as well, don't they? A lot more girls.
Goths and academic overachievers will read manga, but it's this teenage thing. It used to be emo in music. I don't know about music now, so I don't know how.
I don't even know if emo is a current thing anymore. I think it's gone full circle. I think they call themselves goths again now.
Right. But yeah, they will be the kids, the subset. A bit like, well, you've undoubtedly had endless conversations about how nerdy and geeky has changed its demographic, and it has become a cool thing.
Yeah.
And with the comic festivals, since I stopped going to comic festivals have erupted, which is why I've got to get back into it. Because this past weekend, not only the Lakes took place, and I'm finding out about the Lakes world, but I only discovered today that the MCM Comic Expo had been doing a virtual thing as well. Two big comic festivals taking place this past weekend from different universes, almost never the twain. It's
totally
like that
different.
Small press world of Lakes and people announcing graphic novels and movies and TV shows. Almost a Venn diagram that doesn't overlap.
Yeah.
And I've got to find out about both because because I am that overlap. It's, I'm what you've been waiting for. I'm the guy who's worked for the Beano, who's worked for Marvel and who adapts Shakespeare. There Show me go. Anybody else who does that.
That's a pretty distinct set of circumstances there, isn't it? But I think that's the thing. There's a lot of people like yourself, actually, Kev, who have sort of been working very hard on their own endeavours and sort of not rediscovered what's actually happening in the comics world. And I think when we did those chats on Hannah's forums, I don't think you were the only one that sort of had their eyes opened a little bit. And that's why I really enjoyed them, because there were so many people on them. People were able to learn about other parts of the comic industry or other parts of the comics community. I myself included, you know.
Very much so.
Really interesting people.
The thing that struck me, I missed the first one, which I would have had more of a contribution to. The second one was about access and diversity, so I didn't really have a lot to bring to the party there. But what was said by one of the panelists was that back in the day when she was starting to produce graphic novels, there were no events like the Lakes Comic Festival.
I was on that one,
She was talking about the years when my comic festival was on. What she meant was that there wasn't anything which was taking the sort of Guardian readers publishing world seriously. And there was only the slightly boyish superhero orientated, or as far as they knew, that was all that existed. I mean, my attempts to have Dennis the Menace on my poster and bring in kids, which did succeed, it clearly wasn't heard about by Guardian readers in London.
No, which was a shame. That's the amazing thing. It doesn't matter how much you put yourself out there as an event organizer. Doesn't matter how aggressive you are with your marketing, you will still miss out on swathes of the population. And that lady obviously was completely unaware of your events, completely unaware of my events, you know, and probably
she would have been aware of others. Paul Gravett's events, which are Paul Gravett, Posy Simmons, Brian Talbot. They're sort of a triumvirate of the people who are taken seriously by the wider media, which is great. You know, The Late Show when it used to be on, The Guardian, The Independent, probably The Telegraph and The Times. Serious, good old-fashioned journalism will take them seriously. The fact that it's been Posy Simmons and Brian Talbot
for the last 30 years,
and your man Briggs for the last 30 years. For a while, it used to be Viz as well. Viz in Newcastle, not Viz the manga people. They were the ones who were taken seriously. And I did approach many of the people. Brian would always come to my events, but Posy Simmons was never able to. Marjan Satrapi came to one of the Bristol events before I'd ever heard of her. And a few people did come to my events. We had the posse who came over from Norway. I never managed to find an inn with the French market and with the Japanese.
It's very difficult actually. I did get a contact with Posy through Paul, actually, through Paul Gravett.
Paul came to mine, of course.
Paul used to come to my events and do talks and stuff, and we almost got Posy for the Shrewsbury event, actually, but for some reason or another the timing just wasn't right. But I really would like to get those. I mean, I know that you wanted to as well, to get a really good cross section of people so that so that it shows that there really is something for everyone, but it's hard to do that sometimes.
The hostility to comic events lingered a long while. I mean, Pat Mills, who comes up to the Lakes event, but every year Pat Mills would say, no, I don't come to events like that. It's all full of fanboys who want to read superhero comics. Mm. And he said that to me in person, only because we met at an airport, not that we would have met at one of my festivals.
Oh, really?
And it wasn't until you basically got a Guardian-friendly festival that Pat would be back on board. Yeah. When, oh, my backdrop's just fallen down.
Your backdrop's fallen down.
There you go. Yeah, because on my Mac, I actually
need
to
have... It's a good job it's audio, isn't it?
I need to have a green screen in order to put a backdrop up.
Yes, yeah.
And now you see, this is what my studio really looks like.
Hey, the illusion has gone. The wizard is turning the wheel.
Yeah, it's quite a small room I work in now. I used to have a studio up the road, but the landlords wanted to convert it into somebody's kitchen, so they did. But I used to have a vast place which had everything. It had all my wife's sculptures in, and it had my comic collection. So for 2 years now, my comic collection has been in a storage unit in Bristol, and I haven't been able to. I've been doing these without basically having anybody else's comics to rip off, which I think has done me it's done me good. It has. Mm. I've developed a technique of posing for photos and improving my drawing from that. You'll find a lot of photos of me in these sort of dramatic poses.
Realistic pose, just to get the good proportions and stuff like that.
But then with Midsummer Night's Dream Team, I tried to do less of that. So I actually worked more with drawing the figures myself. So it's much more cartoony. But then I did some for shots. I realised that we've gone over our original plan.
We have a little bit. That's okay. I'm not too strict with it, but I am always aware that sometimes my guests are waiting to eat their tea.
No, it's not that. I ate before we came. But both you and I are at 8 o'clock going to join the next Hanoveri chat, aren't we?
We are. So we need to cut this short so that we can
put our backdrops up.
Yeah, put our backdrops up and talk to Hannah. So, yeah, well, I'll say, Kev, thank you so much for this evening and taking the time out to talk to me. It's been a really good... I've almost managed to get a word in edgeways on occasion, which I'm very proud of.
I'm really hard to edit as well, because these... They're all one long sentence, you will discover. When you try and find the punctuation, take there.
Well, I knew what I was going to get before I started, so that's fine. And it's been really, really good to talk to you. And I really hope that these three books do well. I think you should try and get them into schools, because I think there's a market there for them. And yeah, I can't wait to hopefully have a read of them as well myself, because they look great.
I will get you copies, don't you worry about that, Shane. I'm honoured and flattered, really pleased that you let me do this.
It's great to have you on. It really is. It's great to have you on. Thank you so much. And I'll see you very shortly on the next online event.
On the Zoom chat. Cheerio, folks. It's been fun. Bye-bye.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
See you, Kev.
Cheers, Shane.
Cheers.